From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. President Trump is denying today that he was told about a June 2016 meeting in Trump Tower, which involved his son, Donald Jr., who we now know was expecting damaging information on Hillary Clinton from a Russian lawyer. The allegation that Trump did know comes from Trump's personal lawyer, former personal lawyer, that is, Michael Cohen. According to CNN, Cohen says he's willing to make that assertion to the special counsel, Robert Mueller. Trump and his son have denied that Trump had advanced knowledge of that meeting. Here's Donald Trump Jr. talking about it a year ago with Fox News' Sean Hannity.
Did you tell your father anything about this?
No. It was such a nothing. There was nothing to tell. I mean, I wouldn't have even remembered it until you start scouring through the stuff. It was literally just a wasted 20 minutes, which was a shame.
Let's bring in NPR's Carrie Johnson. And Carrie, I'm looking at the president's tweet from this morning. It said, "I did not know of the meeting with my son, Don Jr." So how do we know who's telling the truth here?
Well, Michael Cohen has told, or someone close to Michael Cohen has told CNN that there were other people apparently who were witnesses to this conversation, but Michael Cohen apparently did not record the conversation or the interaction with President Trump himself. So there are some steps that investigators might want to take here to try to figure out who's telling the truth now. One of the challenges is that both sides here have had credibility challenges in the past in talking about this June 2016 meeting at Trump Tower. The president and the White House have denied different aspects of that meeting. Michael Cohen apparently didn't tell congressional investigators what he has gone on to tell others and was reported by CNN. So there are credibility challenges all around here. We're going to have to look for other witnesses and possibly phone records.
Why does it matter whether President Trump knew about this meeting in advance, besides the fact that he says he didn't?
This is important, Jeremy. Really important question here. And what happened here is this meeting, it turns out, it's now clear, was an offer by people close to the Russian government to provide dirt on Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump's political opponent, in the heart of the 2016 campaign. That could have some legal implications if, for instance, there was an offer of something of value like opposition research or data analytics or email dumps in terms of election law. But it also could have some political consequences for a campaign and now a White House that has persistently denied conspiring with, collaborating with, colluding with anybody in the Russian government. So there are multiple levels of inquiry here and multiple levels of potential risk for President Trump.
And it's pretty obvious now that Cohen has completely turned on Trump, and the Trump team appears to be changing its own position on Cohen. Here's Trump's attorney, Rudy Giuliani, on CNN last night.
He's been lying for years. The tapes that we have demonstrate any number of very serious lies by him back a year and a half ago, including his fooling people, hiding tape recordings, lying to their face, breaking faith with them, taping his client, which is a disbarrable offense. I don't see how he has any credibility.
So the gloves are off, but it's interesting because as recently as May 6th, Giuliani called Cohen an honest, honorable lawyer. What's going on in this relationship?
What appears to be going on in this relationship is a divorce we're all watching in real time. Michael Cohen just earlier this year said that he would take a bullet for President Trump. And then only a few weeks ago, he told ABC News that his first loyalty was to his family and to the country. Cohen has since come out and said he believes the U.S. intelligence community assessment that Russia did try to interfere with and attack the U.S. election in 2016. And he appears to have some information he wants to provide the government. It's not clear why he's adopting this strategy, though. Typically, the Justice Department will want to hear from potential witnesses in private, behind closed doors, do full debriefings, try to corroborate accounts, as opposed to watch all of this play out in real time on television, which is not the way prosecutors typically want to go about building a case.
Well, and according to CNN, Cohen says there are other people, other witnesses, that could say that President Trump was informed about that meeting before it happened. What's next in figuring out the facts here?
Well, investigators at the Justice Department and investigators in the Congress surely know more than we do about this. They probably already have the identities of some of those people and perhaps have locked in testimony or interviews with some of them already. It's important to note that Michael Cohen was asked a question, at least one question about this by congressional investigators. He did not say during that session that President Trump was aware of this Trump Tower meeting before it happened. So that is one point on which his credibility is under attack. And they're going to want to need to find out whether he's telling the truth, what he's telling the truth about, and whether anybody else saw or heard what he says he saw and heard.
That's NPR Justice Correspondent Carrie Johnson. Carrie, thank you.
My pleasure.
Okay, Jeremy, obviously that's a very serious political story, but there was some more lighthearted political news this week. Republican Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah wants us all to know he is not dead.
Really?
Yeah, he and his staff reminded the world that he is very much alive after Google falsely reported his death.
Joining us now with more on this and other stories making a buzz this week on social media is Femi Okeh, host of The Stream.
Hey there, Jeremy.
Hi there. How are you?
I love the way that you said, really?
Really?
He's not dead? Yes.
Well, so Orrin Hatch is alive. We should be clear about that. And his staff have been busy this week tweeting pictures of him as evidence. How are people reacting online?
Well, how it all happened was people being very mischievous online on Wikipedia. And anyone can change your Wikipedia posting. So the post changed for Senator Orrin Hatch for his death. So he died, apparently, according to Wikipedia, on September the 11th, 2017.
That was cruel of whoever did that, by the way.
It was mean. And then it took a little while for Google in their Google searches to actually say, hey, actually, he's not really dead. Twitter had a field day. Adam Bruski said, guys, zombie Orrin Hatch is tweeting again. Not convinced that it wasn't really a dead Orrin Hatch on Twitter. Max Kennelly says, I am so sorry to hear about your passing. I hope you're taking it well. Lots of very rude comments about dying inside. I won't repeat any of those. But Chad Johnson says maybe Google was talking about the ethics and your love of America. Maybe that died last year. But the fix for this is really easy. One, you can go on Wikipedia and you can fix it. The other thing is you can just alert Google, as Senator Orrin Hatch's team did. Jeff Lynn says, you can just correct the data and not make it a parenthesis weird PR stunt, because if you go on the page, you'll see that his team is tweeting out examples of the fact that he's not dead, although none of them were so current that they convinced me that he couldn't have died maybe the day that he read the newspaper. But that's just because we all believe in conspiracy theories if we're on Twitter. Google communications end up with, well, you certainly are alive and sporting a great sense of humor. We apologize for the error. We have fixed it shortly. And if you look at the Twitter handle, it says at the very end of Senator Hatch office, happy to be alive.
I put that story in the funny but not funny category.
Yes.
There's another one here we want to talk about. Georgia Republican state lawmaker Jason Spencer this week announced that he's going to resign after backlash from his appearance on the new Sacha Baron Cohen show, Who is America? We talked about this earlier in the week. Spencer was yelling racist slurs. At one point, he dropped his pants. It was completely bizarre. Tailor-made for social media in a way, which maybe Sacha Baron Cohen knew. How is Twitter and the rest responding to that?
Well, there's a debate, and the debate is going on about whether, if you're being pranked, whether you should lose your job. Emily Nussbaum tweets out that she's not a big Sacha Baron Cohen fan, but this is a good outcome of this show. I'm also convinced that it was the literally, let me just give you another phrase here, bottom showing that did it, butt showing, not the actual racism and the racist things that he said. So that's the debate about whether this show should be bringing people down. And this apparently is the first stepping down and resignation that the show has actually had or caused, so we say.
Okay, we'll see what happens next. Let's do one more here, Femi, involving the singer R. Kelly, and a warning about this. This is controversial. A lot of people might not want to hear this, but he addressed years of sexual misconduct allegations against him in a new 19-minute song that he released on SoundCloud on Monday called I Admit. And in the lyrics, he acknowledges that he, quote, made some mistakes, but the song ultimately turned out to be more of a defense of his behavior. We're going to play a part of this song now. He has just admitted in the song to being involved with both older and young ladies.
You may have your opinions, entitled to your opinions. But really, am I supposed to go to jail or lose my career because your opinion?
Femi, First of all, just remind us what this was all about.
Oh, multiple accusations. So R. Kelly was running an abusive and controlling cult of young women, that he's been grooming young women, particularly a 14-year-old girl, to be his lover. He passed on STDs. He gets women drunk, gives them drugs, and right. so on and so on and so on. And still his music remains popular amongst a lot of people.
So what are people saying about this song?
So I went onto YouTube because obviously people are watching the song on YouTube, listening, quoting, posting their reactions. C. Wharton says, "Love R. Kelly." This is after the song. Willie Campbell says, "I'm so sick of these random women trying to bring R. Kelly down." Betty Tanner, interesting from a female perspective here, "I was forced to listen to this song in the car, and not once did he admit anything except that he thinks it's okay to play around with girls if parents offer them up, huh?" Mm. So I think the controversy rolls on because R. Kelly still makes music, people still love his music, and there's still all these accusations out there, and I'm not sure people were buying his I'm Sorry song.
And we will not end this segment with R. Kelly, but Femi Okeh of The Stream, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Hey, you! Let us through. It's a bright new star. Oh, come. That, of course, is the late Robin Williams as the genie in Disney's Aladdin. You can't even rent Aladdin right now, but you can see it on stage. It's been a Broadway hit, and it's touring now. Michael James Scott plays the genie in the touring production, which I just saw. He joins us in the studio. Welcome. And did you see this movie as a kid?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, absolutely. I mean, I grew up with the brilliance that is Aladdin. And as you grow up, you never forget, you know, the music and
right.
and the story. It's Aladdin. So, yes.
What do you remember about it?
I remember like the very first sort of thing when Robin Williams is like, come closer. Oh, too close. For some reason, I just remember that.
Yeah.
And then, I remember, you know, A Friend Like Me.
Mr. Alonzo, what will your pleasure be?
Let me take your order, jot it down.
You ain't never had a friend like me.
But I also, like, I did my first tap solo with A Friend Like Me, so I think that that's probably another big reason why I remember that particular song.
Now, for people who don't know this movie, whoever they are, or this play, you are a magical genie who helps Aladdin become a prince so that he can romance the Princess Jasmine. And it is a role where you, like the late Robin Williams, have to talk, sing, change characters very quickly. I want to put you on the spot for a second and just have you give us a little taste of what you have to do in this show. Just, I mean, I'm sure that you know all of your lines and all of your songs, but give me a little bit of one of them. Anyone where you have to go really fast, because I was very impressed by that.
Well, like, if say I'm talking to you right now, and then all of a sudden I would switch to, "Ladies and gentlemen, now you're here on this game show, and we have to go into this." And then I would switch into something like, "Hey, y'all, we're here now, here in the lab. We're doing a little banjo band. I'm in the country music." Then I could switch and go into my full Beyonce mode, where I'm giving you a lot of this and that and that. But then I would switch right back into the, like, what do you think of the genie? So it's kind of, you think about a switch literally like turning the channel, which is kind of fun and exhausting.
I want to listen to a little bit of the genie that many know, and that would of course be Robin Williams. Here he is. He did a lot of improv in the film. Here he is during the song Prince Ali.
He's got 75 golden candles.
Don't they look lovely, June? Fabulous, Harry. I love the feathers.
When it comes
so
to
he's making fun of the Macy's Thanksgiving parade, which you don't do.
Yeah, we don't do.
No.
Yeah. So we go into the sort of Fats Waller, you know, Cab Calloway feel, which it has more that more jazzy kind of a kind of a thing, you know. So this was to for it to really feel like a parade, you know, of costumes and scenery. And as you'll see in the show, our ensemble changes 4 times during this number.
Right.
Which is insane. And they all come, you know, and then and what it's sort of representing is that, like, it's a different part of the parade. And I love this particular feel that we have in the show because that old school, you know, hey, clear the way. It's such a throwback. It almost makes people a little bit surprised when they see and hear it because it's so different. The sound is so different. But this is kind of what it was originally intended to sort of be, is to have that old big band, you know, feeling.
What's your favorite song to sing in that show?
Gosh. I think... There are 2 moments for me. There's a new song that was written for the show called Somebody's Got Your Back, and it's in the second act, and it's with the genie and Aladdin and with Aladdin's friends.
How does that go?
And it goes, ain't it great to know somebody's got your back? Like, it has a very soft shoe kind of a feel, and I love to sing it. I love to sing it. And I also love A Whole New World, of course. I don't get to sing it. I sing it at the very end. I sing a little snippet, and I love singing it because it's just such a fun thing. You know, when you come out and you're, a whole new world, that's where I'll be. It's just such a beautiful moment. It's sort of, it's just an open feeling to get to do that.
Do you improvise a lot?
Yeah, I get to improvise a bit. And we kind of cater it for each, you know, city that we're in, which is kind of fun, and give some specific things for that city, which is...
When you were in Australia as the genie, you used to pull out some Vegemite.
I did. I pulled out Vegemite out of my pocket, which, of course, the Aussies loved. And that was... It got a really, really big reaction and really big response, which is really fun.
Now, this is a role that you have played many times, including in Australia, and you're about to go play the same role in London.
Yes, yes. Yeah, I never would have...
Is that because you love it or because they love you doing it?
Well, I think it's probably maybe a little bit of both. Uh-huh. I mean, I love doing it, and the opportunities have been continuing to come, which is incredible and such a gift. And I'm beyond thankful to the Disney team to sort of put me as, you know, kind of an international genie, which is kind of, I never, ever, ever expected and even imagined, to be honest with you.
Do the audiences in these different countries respond differently?
Yes and no. They all have the same love for it. You know, it's kind of like how, you know, music is a universal language. I feel like Aladdin is like the universal show, you know, where people just love it so much and they want to love it. They want to love you, you know, and as the genie, I mean, you know, as an actor, like, that's kind of really cool that the audiences want to love you, you know. So I think that the love is the same everywhere. The differences are just sort of how the jokes land and where people laugh, which is always great for me as an actor to learn, and such a great learning experience because it's so different in every country.
You've also been on Broadway. You originated the Maggots guy in the hugely popular The Book of Mormon.
I did, yes.
Who is the Maggots guy?
I can't remember. Is very proud. The doctor. He's actually the doctor. But he sings about having that in his... He sings about having maggots in his...
Can you do it for us?
Am I allowed to actually say it?
Go do it. Do it. We can bleep it. I think you can probably say that. Okay. And then I want to ask you about another role.
Yeah.
You were the minstrel in Something Rotten.
Yes.
And we have some of you singing Welcome to the Renaissance.
Oh! Welcome to the Renaissance, with poets, painters, and bon vivants, and merry minstrels who show the streets of London a strum in their lutes,
in puffy pants and pointy leather boots.
Welcome to the Renaissance, where we ooh and ah you with thumbbeats. We're so pro.
You want to complete the song for us? Go for it.
Yes. With much ado, welcome to the Renaissance, where everything is new.
What do you like doing the most, by the way? Because you have to sing, you have to act, and you have to dance.
Oh gosh. I mean, I love them all. Truly. I grew up singing in church. So singing was the first thing that I did. And I say this all the time, but my mother said I sang before I spoke. Mm-hmm. So singing is it's just within me. And I come from a family with lots of music around. So singing is amazing, but there is no feeling like dancing though, too. You know, like when you get a big dance number to get to really like, do you know what I mean? My inspiration is like Fred Astaire, Gene Kelly, mm-hmm. Ben Vereen, Sammy Davis. Like those cats are like, that's everything for me. So to be able to get to dance that as well, I don't know. There's something about it that I love, and it feels so freeing to get to do.
Do you prefer to tour or to do this on Broadway or in one place?
Oh, gosh, I love it all. You know, it's different when you're on Broadway because it feels a little bit like, you know, because you have your life and you're going to work. And, you know, it's weird because when I say work, I never ever thought that I would be going to work to be doing a show. Mm-hmm. So it feels strange when you're sort of like in New York, because that is, it's like you go and you sleep and then you go to work, you know. But on the road is different. It feels a little bit like you're on a vacation. You know, you kind of get to hang out with a bunch of, your family is basically around you all of time. You know, your whole cast and the crew, like we're all together all the time. So it feels like a fun little vacation.
How long do you want to keep being the genie?
I'll be the genie as long as I can do it. As long as my body will let me do it. Good Lord. But I love it. And, you know, when you play the genie, if you're having a bad day and you come in to play the genie, it's the best medicine for you to get rid of all of that and get to come in and play a character with so much light.
Michael James Scott, before we let you go, I am going to ask you to sing something from Aladdin. I tried a few times. It didn't work, but now I'm going to directly ask you to sing.
All right. All right. All right. All right. Wah, wah, wah. Ooh, wah. Wah, wah, wah. No, no. Wah, wah, wah. Ha, ha, ha. Well, Alibaba had them 40 thieves. Shahrazad had 1,000 tales. Well, master, you're in luck, because up your sleeve, you got a brand of magic never fails. You got some power in your corner now. Some heavy ammunition in your camp. You got some punch, pizzazz, yahoo and how. See, all you got to do is rub that lamp.
It's Michael James Scott, who stars as the genie in the touring production of Aladdin. We've got more information on the show at hereandnow.org. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Now, now, now. Life is your restaurant, and I'm your maitre d'. Come on, whisper what it is you want. You ain't never had a friend like me. Yes, sir. We bought ourselves on service. But you the boss, the king, the shah. Say what you wish, it's yours, true dish. How about a little more baklava? There it is.
U.S. economic growth jumped to 4.1% in the second quarter of the year, making it the third best GDP number since the Great Recession. The Commerce Department also revised the first quarter GDP number up to 2.2% from 2%. Today, President Trump touted the numbers at the White House.
If economic growth continues at this pace, the United States economy will double in size more than 10 years faster than it would have under either President Bush or President Obama.
For more on this, we're joined by NPR senior business editor Uri Berliner. Uri, before we start, is there any song from Aladdin you want to sing?
No, I'm not going to try that. Okay. Don't set me up that way,
okay.
Jeremy, please.
Well, tell us about what's behind these numbers. This is a pretty big jump from the first quarter.
Yeah, this was a strong quarter across the board with higher consumer spending, stronger business investment, and an increase in exports. So it is really solid across the board, and there's no way around it. 4.1% is a really good quarter.
Do the tax cuts have a lot to do with this?
We don't know precisely the role the tax cuts play. I mean, that's not laid out in this report. But just the jump in consumer spending means that consumers had more money in their pocketbooks. They were spending more. And it's very likely that some of that has to do with the bump they had in their paychecks. Also, business investment, corporate tax rates were lower. It stands to reason that some of the reason they were spending more is because of lower tax rates. And also, some U.S. companies brought back these profits they had parked overseas back into the U.S. because of some of the incentives in that tax bill.
We have been saying, as we've been talking about this today, that this is the best number since 2014, about 4 years ago, during the Obama administration. So put this into some historic context for us.
Well, a single quarter of growth of 4% or more is not that rare. It happens in many, many administrations, and often for more than a single quarter. What is unusual is to have sustained growth of 4%. That is extremely unusual. I mean, for this administration, I think a sustained growth of 3% over a year or two or three, that would be a significant achievement, a significant accomplishment, because the post-recession growth rates have been a lot lower, 1.5 to 2%.
Well, and also the U.S. is a developed economy. We look at a place like China, a developing economy, they're growing at like 6% or even more sometimes. But should we really expect growth in this country to be that high?
No, I mean, that is extremely unrealistic for an advanced economy like the U.S. or European economy to grow at 4%. I think what we should really be looking at is historically, the U.S. for over the past century or so has grown at about 3% a year. And that has kept the size of the economy growing quickly, that it would double over time in a certain number of years. But recently, it's been growing at much lower rate, 1.5 to 2%. That's kept incomes back. It's kept investment back. And it's really, you know, affected people in serious, profound ways in their pocketbooks. So if the economy could get back to 3% on a sustained basis, that would be a real achievement. But we don't know whether that's going to happen.
Well, and there are already concerns that President Trump's trade war is going to knock this number down in the coming quarters.
Exactly. So the economy got a boost, paradoxically, from tariffs in the second quarter because, like China, for example, was buying more soybeans in anticipation of these tariffs.
Right.
And now they aren't going to be buying soybeans, as many soybeans or any soybeans at all. And if the tariffs really kick in, that could really curtail the rate of growth.
NPR Senior Business Editor Uri Berliner, thank you.
You're welcome, Jeremy.
Hundreds of families in Syria are getting grim news about the fate of their missing relatives. The government is sending them notices that say their loved ones are dead. There is no explanation about how they died, though human rights groups say it's a sign that President Assad believes he's winning the civil war that started in 2011. What is clear is that the violence in that country has not stopped. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for attacks in southern Syria on Wednesday that killed more than 200 people. We're going to take a deeper look now at the Syrian conflict with the BBC chief international correspondent, Lise Doucette. She's been to Syria many times since that war started, and she joins us now from London. Lise, this is a major offensive from the Islamic State. Why now?
Yes, a spare thought for the people of Sueda, who is a city in the south of Syria, close to the border with Jordan. It's a place which was spared most of the worst of the violence, which has racked Syria for 7 years and more since the unrest, the uprising, first began in 2011. And now they have been the target in one of the deadliest attacks, possibly the deadliest attacks, by so-called Islamic State, with their gunmen and suicide bombers going into attacking multiple times around the city as the fighters, you know, tore through the marketplace, through the vegetable stalls. And it's a reminder that in Syria, as one war seems to be simmering or moving to a new phase, that other wars are now surging. And this one is proving to be a very, very deadly one. It's not the first time Islamic State has struck. Certainly, it has been a bloody, bloody attack.
And yet, we have been hearing in this country that ISIS has been defeated in Iraq and in Syria. In fact, President Trump said as much this week when he spoke to the VFW convention. Let's listen to some of that.
We're destroying the bloodthirsty killers known as ISIS, almost gone.
In fact, the U.S. military said earlier this year that the Islamic State has been ousted from 98% of its territory. So how were they able to coordinate such an attack if that's true?
Well, President Trump used the word almost gone. There's always been discussion about how do you describe the battle against Islamic State? Can you really defeat them? The military sometimes uses the word degrade. It's, I think, wiser wiser voices have been saying that even though it is true the territorial control of Islamic State in both Iraq and Syria to neighboring countries is now pretty well almost gone, it doesn't mean that IS is gone. First of all, a lot of the fighters melted back into the local populations. Secondly, there was also known to be sleeper cells where they have sympathizers throughout society. And it's been said that they will move from the kind of set piece combat that we've seen in recent years as the United States and its allies in Syria and Iraq fought against Islamic State, that now IS will, like other extremist groups like Al-Qaeda, turn to an insurgency. And that's what we've seen in Sweda, and that's what we've seen in attacks in Damascus, the capital, and in other major cities like Homs.
Isn't that much harder to fight, slipping, melting into the population rather than having a territorial capital that you can go after?
Well, indeed. It seems as though the Syrian forces must have been caught by surprise by this attack in Sweda. Don't forget, this is taking place in a part of Syria where in recent weeks we've seen Syrian forces backed by Russia and Iran pushing the rebels who had been backed by the United States and other Western countries from almost the beginning of the uprising. It was where, this is the area of southern Syria called Deraa, and some of your listeners may remember that the first protests in Syria in March of 2011 began in Deraa. It's described as the cradle of the revolution. So the focus of Syrian government forces was to push the rebels, including some hardline Islamist groups, from that area of Syria. And just having finished that, they now are countering another very, very powerful enemy.
And how close is Assad to wrapping up that war with the rebels? We've been hearing that area we're talking about is very much the last stronghold.
There are wars within wars in Syria, and the war in Syria stopped being primarily about Syria a very long time ago. So yes, the battle that most viewers and listeners would know about from the 2011, the peaceful protests, which turned to armed opposition to President Assad, that is winding down. Most of the rebels have been pushed out of their strongholds. Most of them are now, the remaining ones, now that they've lost the south, are in a corner of northwestern Syria, and there those rebel forces are dominated by the more hardline groups, including groups linked to Al-Qaeda. But all of these rebel groups are backed by one outside power or another. There have been so many, as we call them, proxy wars within Syria. And what we've seen in recent months is an escalation of the involvement of outside players who've now not only backing sides right now. They have their own conflicts are unfolding. So you have Israel attacking targets inside Syria connected to Iran. You have Syrian forces retaliating. You have Turkish forces in the north. Syria is not just a war-torn country. It's a country which is divided now as outside players assert control in different parts of the country.
I do want to ask you about Israel. Of course, they shot down a Syrian jet that entered Israeli airspace just this week, and Syrians shot down an Israeli jet earlier this year. Talk about the risk of escalation in the region, especially with Israel.
Israel has made clear from the very beginning of the Syrian conflict that they had one, if not two, red lines. One of them was whenever it saw any sign that Lebanon's Hezbollah fighters, which are allied and a key ally of President Assad and Iran in Syria, whenever there was any sign that any weapons were going across the border to Lebanon, which of course is also on Israel's border, that Israel would stop it. So for years, Israel used to strike targets inside Syria, what were said to be Hezbollah targets, but it would never take credit, would never say that we carried them out. In recent years, as Iran's influence has risen, that's become its second red line, that Israel will not allow Iran to have any long-term military presence close to Israel's border. And so in 2018, we've seen more strikes against Syrian and Iranian targets in Syria by Israel than for all of 2017. So it's escalating.
And in this proxy war, of course, civilians, human beings, are caught up. I want to play some tape from last week's meeting between President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Here's Putin talking about cooperation between the United States and Russia in Syria.
Russia and the United States apparently can act proactively and take assumed leadership in this issue and organize the interaction to overcome humanitarian crisis and help Syrian refugees to go back to their homes.
Millions of refugees, of course, we know have fled the country. There's talk of them going back now that this war winds down. What's the latest on that? Is that happening?
Yes, it's interesting you play that that clip. I was at that Helsinki press conference between President Putin and President Trump. It's believed they did discuss Syria. President Putin said that after the meeting, in those remarks, he said that President Trump wanted to talk about Syria. And in fact, I just heard from an Arab government minister that Russia is very keen for some of the refugees in neighboring countries like Lebanon and Jordan to return to Syria. And certainly the Lebanese and the Jordanians want them to return. But the question is whether President Assad wants people to come back now, whether there's a place for people to come back now.
Whether it's safe for them to come back now.
Whether it's safe to come back, but also it's about the kind of population. People will come back. Some of them would have been people who supported the uprising, although they won't want to talk about that or be identified with that. Syria is a country which needs money for reconstruction. So these are political and financial issues. But this is Russia wants to find a way to wind down this war. It wants a smooth transition to some kind of political change, although, of course, it's widely known that even though they say they're not wedded to President Assad personally, it's more keeping the system intact to avoid the collapse we've seen in other neighboring states. But it's widely believed they see President Assad as the best bet to guarantee Russia's interest in the region and to keep Syria's basically from falling apart. Hmm.
That's the BBC's chief international correspondent, Lise Doucet, speaking with us from London. Lise, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Parents of addicts are routinely advised to be tough with their kids, to cut them off if necessary.
I was being told about tough love.
Tough love.
Rock bottom.
Rock bottom.
The belief is that somebody using substances, the only way they're going to change is if they have a massive pileup of negative consequences. That's not true.
Those are the opening lines from a new video that parents can use to help them deal with a child who is addicted to drugs. It was produced by the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids, and it promotes compassion and understanding rather than punishment. Martha Biebinger from member station WBUR reports.
It was Bea Duncan who reached for the phone at 2 a.m. on a January morning 9 years ago. Her son Jeff had been caught using drugs inside a sober home and was being kicked out. Bea and her husband, Doug Duncan, went and picked up their son. On the ride back home, they gave him an ultimatum.
It was either going back to the rehab or he had to leave home.
Bea Duncan says her son chose to leave. She remembers a lot of yelling, cursing, and tears as they stopped the car.
It was really, really difficult to actually just drop him off in a parking lot on our way home and say, you made the decision, no rehab, so we made the decision, no home. It was exquisitely difficult.
But in line with guidance Doug Duncan had received from other parents.
He's got to hit rock bottom. You're going to have to kick him out of the house.
Two torturous days later, Jeff Duncan came home. While he was in rehab for the second time, the Duncans decided their approach was not working. They sought help, eventually connecting with a program called CRAFT that stresses empathy over tough love.
I think there was more compassion and was more, wow, this is really difficult for you, more open questions to him instead of dictating what he should and should not behave like. And I started to feel an immense, a sense of relief.
Because Bea Duncan could focus on being a loving mom, not a cop.
I stopped having to feel like I had to be a private investigator and a controlling mom. And I could kind of walk side to side with him on this journey instead of feeling like I had to take charge of it.
The Duncans credit flipping from family consequences, like kicking their son out of the house, to outside ones, like losing a job due to drug use, with helping their son stick to recovery. Jeff's now 28 and sober for 9 years. Many drug users say, in hindsight, they appreciate being forced into treatment. But studies show that a compassionate approach and voluntary treatment are more likely to keep people alive. Nora Volkoff is director of the National Institute on Drug Abuse.
The concept of letting their children hit bottom is not the best strategy, because in hitting bottom, they may die.
But parents, desperate for help, often don't know how to avoid hitting the bottom, as the Duncans did on that frigid January morning, leaving their son in a dark, empty parking lot. Today, Doug Duncan is a parent coach through the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. He's on the phone with Doreen, a mom whose daughter is in recovery. We're only using Doreen's first name to protect her daughter's identity.
I was just wondering, if you were to reach out to your daughter, how you might do that.
Doreen is upset about an angry text from her daughter, who has overdosed twice.
It brings me back there. In 2 seconds, I am back on that scene, thinking she's back on the heroin, she's not going to live.
But instead of panicking and replying with a confrontational text, Doreen pauses and searches for ways to be supportive.
That's really huge. It's really hard to do that, too. Your mind's screaming out. Ask that question.
Help get me out of here. I just want to ask her if she's taking drugs. But that's almost like an accusation.
Parent-to-parent coaching for 5 or 6 sessions is one feature of a new collaboration between the Graykin Center at Boston Medical Center and the Partnership for Drug-Free Kids. Families who call or text a hotline will have an initial conversation with a licensed therapist and get referrals for more services, including coaching. The Graykin Center's Michael Botticelli says parents need more help and ways to think about addiction as a disease.
If you listen to parents, they will say, well, you know, if their child had cancer, they wouldn't just completely disengage with them or be angry with them. So I do think that it aligns kind of our scientific understanding that addiction is a disease and not a moral failure with some of the practices that we know to be helpful and effective and probably much more compassionate and humane.
Parent coaches say compassion is not enabling. There are still limits and consequences, including jail time if warranted. But the parent's primary role is to support and understand. Joanne Peterson, who founded the Parent Support Network Learn to Cope, says coaches can help, but not in every case.
If someone doesn't feel safe in the home, what do you do? If somebody is under the influence and being violent, what do you do? It's great that we have more resources, and I applaud that, but we also need more professional help.
Meaning counselors, nurses, and doctors who really understand what it's like to live with and try to help someone in the throes of an addiction. For Here and Now, I'm Martha Biebinger.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.